We're holding page 164 in Bava Basra, middle of the page, Atshon Akoina Shnei Lonis, which is the middle of Rosh Samachtes. So the Mishnah had been talking about different cases where a person buys trees in somebody else's property. We talked about it a little bit yesterday. So in this connection, the Gemara brings up the point that again, you have, if he buys only one or two trees, he's not really entitled to any land together with the trees. Just like a bare minimum, he has like an easement around the trees to be able to go and pick the fruit, but he doesn't really own any of the land per se. So in this connection, the Gemara brings from a Mishnah in Masechta Bikurim, Hakoina Shnei Lonis Pesach Soder Shel Chaveiro. If a person buys two trees, or one tree for that matter, in somebody else's field, and now he wants to bring Bikurim from those trees, maybe he brings Bikurim to Ene Kodei, but he doesn't say the Psukim for them. Rav Meir Omer, maybe the Kodei Bechola. Rav Meir says that he could say the Psukim as well. Umasaka Gemara, so the Gemara goes through a whole discussion about it, and eventually the Gemara concludes the Lahai Tana Sapuki Masaka Ikonakauka Eloi. The Tanakama of that Mishnah, and by the way, usually the Tanakama is Reb Meir, but here obviously not, since Reb Meir is disagreeing. Anyway, the Tanakama of that Mishnah says there's a suffix, did he actually acquire Kauka or not? So because of that suffix, he does have to bring Bikurim, but therefore he can't say the Psukim, because as the Gemara is going to say soon, there's reasons why. Now you could argue Psukim up Psukim, what's wrong with saying Psukim? But the Gemara is going to soon point out a reason why not.
Don't talk to anywhere else.
If he owned Kauka someplace else, then he would bring Bikurim from that Kauka, of course. But right, we're talking about he's bringing from these trees, and yeah. The point is, so the question is, though, after all, the Gemara says, after all, they may very well be Bikurim, because maybe he does own the land, and then shouldn't he have to say the Psukim? How can you tell him, bring Bikurim, but don't say the Psukim? The fact is, you do have a Chiyuv in the Torah to say the Psukim when you're supposed to. And the answer is, Da'ovet lahu kirab Yosi b'r Chanina. What he does is, with them, he'll do like what Rabbi Yosi Reb Chanina says in this context about Dinim Bikurim, Da'omar, where he says, Botzron v'shidron v'yad shliach, if he harvested the fruit and sent it with a shliach, umes shliach v'derech, but the shliach passed away on the way, So now he has to bring them himself. Maybe the Ena Kodim, now the owner himself, still has to bring the Bikurim, but he won't say the Psukim. So in other words, what we do is that, so the Rashbam explains that it could mean that, that either, when we say that the shliach died, it means, in other words, so the shliach, for example, himself, he was the one who harvested and then sent somebody else to bring it instead of him, or the owner took over after the shliach passed away. So then maybe the inikorda, then you bring the bikurim, but you don't say the psuk. In my time, why? Because the pasuk says, v'lakachta v'hevesa, you should take the bikurim and you should bring them. Now, why does it have to say v'lakachta? Rashbam points out, after all, if you're bringing them, of course you're taking them. So it means we can learn from that, the one who's taking them has to be the one who's bringing them, adjate l'kicha v'avol be'echad, it has to be the same one who was going to bring them in the first place. Is the one who's bringing them now, the Holeka. And if you originally sent it with a shliach, then you don't have that. Now, Rashbam learns that if to begin with, the shliach himself did the harvesting of this fruit, and he's also, you delegated the whole thing to him, you harvest the fruit, you bring it to your shliach, then actually the owner could still say the psukim, because shlucho shalom kamosei. Now, the shliach won't say it, Rashbam points out, because he can't say, that in the psukim, you have a line over there, that I'm thanking you, Hashem, for that I'm thanking you for the fruit, Hashem, asata li Hashem, that Hashem, you gave me. The shliach can't say it, it's not his fruit. However, Rashbam learns that the mashaleach himself could say it, because shlucho shalom kamosei. So now, in the same vein over here, when we have the suffix, he owns two trees, and we don't know whether he owns the land, what he'll do is he'll have the shliach harvest the fruit, but then instead he'll bring it himself, or vice versa. He'll have the one who harvested it won't be the same one who brings it. And therefore that patters it from saying the psukim, and therefore now we don't have the problem that he might have to say the psukim, because now in any case he's potter from that. Tosfos actually learns differently anyway. Tosfos learns that, unlike Rashbam, who says that if the Shliach harvested it and brought it, he would in fact say that the Balabas himself would say the Psukim. Tosfos disagrees and says that no, in that case also, the Balabas wouldn't say it. So according to Tosfos, it's more straightforward. Just delegate the whole thing to a Shliach in that case. So that's how you do it. So the question is, Amalei Rav Acha Breder of Ibri Lelav Ashi, Mechti Psukim Ninu, after all said and done, we're only talking about Psukim, Likri, so let him say the Psukim, what's the difference? You can say Psukim no matter what, whether you're required to or not. Amalei, so he says, well, the reason is from the Mechti Kishikra, because it would look like a falsehood, because after all, you're saying that I'm bringing from the fruit of the land, Hashem Asasa Li Hashem, and if he doesn't in fact own the land, then it would be Mechti Kishikra, it would appear as a falsehood before Hashem. So when he's Koda Batoda, Rashbam explains, when Stam, a person is reading, so when a person reads these Psukim in Chitas or in Kriya, in Shul or whatever, it's not Mechti Kishikra, because he's obviously doing it as learning Torah. But here he's coming to the Beis Hamikdash with his basket of Bikurim, and he's going to say, Ha'adamah Shanasata Li Hashem, if he doesn't actually have Ha'adamah Shanasata Li Hashem, then it'll look like a falsehood, and therefore he can't do it. We have that kind of concept of Mechti Kishikra comes up in various other areas of Halacha as well. In certain cases of davening, for example, sometimes a person makes a mistake in davening and he's taka not yotze and has to daven over because Mechti Kishikra. What's an example? I think one example is, for example, if a person davens a Shabbos davening on weekday and says Mekadesh a Shabbos, then now that it's not Shabbos now. I don't remember if that's a good example, but there are examples like that in Halacha where you have something that's Mechti Kishikra and in fact you have to daven over again.
Because someone would say Einu on Shabbos, or Einu.
Yeah.
If you say Einu in the middle of the week, is it like?
No, Lachol, that's not Mechti Kishikra, because the fact is the Eivishta is our shepherd. Re'enu is a request, which we don't make requests on Shabbos, therefore we change it to Re'enu. No, I don't think that would be an example. Maybe not so much that he says Mekadesh Shabbos, but like if he says Yom Shabbos Hazeh. So say, for example, a person says Ritzeh, in the middle of benching, the Ritzeh Vachasin Yom Shabbos Hazeh. So then that would be Nechsek HaShikr, because now it's not Shabbos. So that's one reason. Rav Misharshia, Breder of Chiyo, another reason, Dumo Osi Lafku Inum is Trumo Meiser. If a person sees that the Psukim have been set over him, he's going to think it's Vadai Bikurim. Now he's going to think that you don't have to take Truma and Meiser from them. You don't take Truma and Meiser from actual Bikurim themselves, because they're one of Matnes Kahuna. But now, if they're not necessarily truly Bikurim, then a person might think they're potter from Truma and Meiser, and they're not, because of the Suffolk. Therefore, the Chachamim will make a Takana. In that case, don't say the Psukim, and do, as we said, do it in some way where you'll be potter from the Psukim anyway, and that way people will realize that it's not truly Bikurim, and they have to take Truma and Meiser from it in Suffolk. Now, this seems to be pretty much a pure thing of halacha, so what's it doing in Ein Yaakov? Habona, and then the bottom of the page over here brings up the point that we see from this, the importance of doing a mitzvah by yourself rather than delegating it to somebody else. The person shouldn't be a Baal Gaiva. Well, I'm too big and too important to go carry a basket of Bikurim myself to the Beis Mikdash. I'm going to delegate it to a Shliach. We find the Mishnah mentions in Bikurim that even Agrippa Samelach, a king who ruled a couple of decades before the Churban, that he personally would take his basket of Bikurim and put it on his shoulder and bring it into the Azara. Before the Eivishta, you don't act like a Baal Gaiva. So now, in other words, we're saying that if a person is going to say, well, you know what, I can't be bothered to do it myself, I'll send it to a shliach, then you can't even allow him to say the psukim, then it amounts to saying a falsehood before the Eibishter, he should have done the mitzvah himself rather than delegating it. Piska, quotation from the Mishnah, a couple of daffin later, the Mishnah describes various cases where a person sells somebody grain or produce, and it turns out to be different than what he said to begin with. So then it's a mechatos. So the Mishnah gives an example. Shamtis, if he sold him reddish or brownish wheat, the nimtzis, he said he's going to be selling him shamtis wheat, v'nimtzis lavona, and it turned out to be white wheat, lavona, v'nimtzis shamtis. So he said he's going to sell him white wheat, and it turned out to be shamtis, this reddish brown color. Shnei michol machse behem, either one can retract before the deal is finalized because the mechatos. Now, this word shamtis is related to the word chama. So therefore, so if we're saying that shlantis is a reddish color, amra papa midikotoni levona, since we have by contrast we have the contrasting kind of wheat, it's called white, and then we're saying that the contrasting kind is called shlantis shmamino. We see from that hoshimsha sumakti. We see therefore that the basic color of the sun is red. And therefore we can call red wheat by the name of the sun, we can call it shlantis. In other words, Rashbam points out there's only two basic colors of wheat. There's no such thing as black wheat, for example. So therefore, if you have a reddish brown color and we're calling it shamtis, evidently that's the real color of the sun. Teda, Rapapa says, you can prove that. Das samkat safro panya. After all, in the morning and in the evening, the sun looks red. The fact that it doesn't look red in the middle, the fact that the rest of the day we don't see it red, it's because our eyesight is not so clear. It's bright, and therefore we're not able to see the sun so directly. You have the famous Gemara in Chulin where the emperor says to Rabbi Yeshua, I want to see your God, and Rabbi Yeshua says, you won't be able to, and the guy says, don't tell me I'm not going to be able to, I demand to, and Rabbi Yeshua takes him outdoors in the middle of the day and tells him, look up at the sun. What do you mean, look up at the sun, I'll go blind? Well, you can't even look at it. One of the Eivishter's servants, you think you could see the Eivishter himself. Anyway, so the Papa is saying the same thing. Then you can't look at the sun in the middle of the day; it's too bright. But essentially, its color is red. Now, what's the nafkamina that's knowing that it's red? First of all, Tosfos points out a nafkamina would be often we have when it comes to definitions of things. We often say that definitions of things are negeya as far as nedarim. So if a person makes a neder, I'm not going to have hanah from anything red, then it would mean I'm not going to look at anything red. Let's say then he can't look at the sun. Because we're saying over here that the sun is essentially red. Ion Yaakov points out another point as well. We have a halacha, you're not allowed to make a picture of the sun. It's a machlokes, because we've shown him whether it applies dafka to a 3D image. Many of you have shown him say it applies even to a 2D image. But in that case, Ion Yaakov says, maybe based on the Gemara, it would only be a problem if it's red. That's not generally accepted by the post-scheme. In general, I think they say that any depiction of the sun in any color is also, when kids, for example, draw pictures of the sun in class, when they draw landscape scenes or whatever in class, if at all possible, what you do is you put the sun like in a corner so they only draw like one quarter of it or something. The post can point out, I think, that Amman points out and other Rishonim after him point out, after all, even though the sun is, of course, three-dimensional, we see it as two-dimensional. So therefore, even a 2D image would be a problem.
Is that because the sun used to be an Avodah Zarah that...
It's not so much... of course, it's because there was the fact that it was an Avodah Zarah, of course, but no, you have a point that Gemara mentions in Rosh Hashanah and in Avodah Zarah, that the Pasuk says, Lois Sasum Iti, the Pasuk says right after that, says the Dibris in Yisrael, don't make with me, and that means, the Gemara mentions, it has a few different meanings. One of them is Lois Sasum Kidmus Sham Moshe Hamasham Sham Lefonei B'morim. Don't make images of Hashem's servants who serve him up in the heavens, and that includes the sun and moon and other heavenly bodies. I mean, no doubt it's because the Mishnah wants to keep us as far away from any trace of Avodah Zarah as possible that Amram Taka brings those halachas in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, and in Shulchan Aruch it's also brought in connection with those halachas, but it's apparently independent. Even if there's nobody in the world anymore who worships the sun, it wouldn't matter. That's the halacha.
Same thing? Yes.
The moon, the same thing, okay. Anyway, so the Gemara continues, Maisvi, though, I have a contradiction. You're telling me that the sun is basically red. But we have the Pasuk says about Tsaras, the Pasuk describes Umarea Omoik Mina Ur. The Pasuk describes that Tsaras is a spot that appears deeper than the skin. In what sense? It's not actually deeper, but it means Kamara Chama Muka Mina Sail. It means like the way that sunlight looks deeper than the shadow. And Tsaras, by definition, is white. So we see, therefore, that the basic color of sun and of the sunlight is white. So the Gemara answers, Kamara Chama Veloy Kamara Chama. What it means is not exactly. It's light, it's in a way like the sunlight, but not exactly. Kamara Chama Da Mukum Natsail. It means the comparison to sunlight is sunlight, also a patch of sunlight, will sometimes look darker than the shady area around it. The Ramban on the Pasuk over there talks about sometimes we see it like that, sometimes not. It'll depend on various factors, and the same thing with the skin. It'll depend on the type of skin and the type of tsaras. So it's like that in that sense. V'loy kamara chama, but not exactly. D'ilu hosam lovan v'hocha adon, because in the sunlight, we're saying, is red, whereas saras is white. Okay. So the Gemara asks, "Lamai the Solika died in the Ikra." Well, let's go back to our initial assumption that our initial assumption was that the sun is white. Now, Rav Papa had explained the sun is essentially red, and that's why in the morning and in the evening, when we're able to look at the sun, when it's not so bright, then we see it as red. But in the middle of the day, he's saying it's too bright for us to look at and know its true color. But if the Gemara's assumption was, by asking the question, that in fact the sun is white, then the question is, then why is it red by day, and why is it red in the morning and in the evening? Now, we would say Balabatish, the reason is because of the atmosphere. We'll talk about that in a second. But the Gemara wants the deeper ruchnistic reason behind it. So the reason is, B'panya, the chalfa pischa de Gehenim. In the evening, the sun looks red because it's passing in front of the entrance of Gehenim. So you have the fire of Gehenim, and the sun reflects that, and therefore it looks red. The safra, and in the morning, the chalfa avardi de Gan Eden. It's passing in front of the roses of Gan Eden. Now, Rashbam points out, Gan Eden is located in the east, Gan Eden Mekedem. Here in the brachas, in Sheva brachas, for example, we sometimes translate Mekedem as meaning from olden times, back in the time of Adam and Chava, but Kedem also means the east, and it means that Gan Eden itself is located in the east. So when the sun is in the east, then it's reflecting off Gan Eden, and when it's in the west, it's reflecting off Gehenim. The Ikadam and the Ipcha, others say the other way around, because what it is not that it flips around the locations of Gan Eden and Gehenim, but rather the idea is when it's in the morning, it would be that it's reflecting off Gehenim, which is towards the west. In other words, you have a reflection across the sky from Gehenim, which is in the west, reflecting across to the sun, which is in the east. And vice versa, in the evening, the sun is in the west, and then you have a reflection across the sky from Gan Eden, which is in the morning. So it still amounts to, it's still Gan Eden and Gehenim, but which one is causing the red color at which time is the argument about it. So what's going on over here? The Maharal has a long explanation on it, of it in his Chedusha HaGodis over here. You ask any scientist, they'll tell you the reason is basically because you have because it's going through a thicker layer of atmosphere in the morning and in the evening, and you have the atmosphere, you have the humidity in the air, and so on and so forth. So he explains, fine. But the Gemara wants to know that humidity itself, that feeling of the air, the cooler air in the morning, and the fact that it feels hotter in the evening after a day's heat. What's the real source of that? So the Gemara is saying, respectively, Gan Eden and Gehenim. So one way of looking at it, in other words, is that in the morning when it feels fresh and when the air feels fresher and clearer, then that's a reflection from Gan Eden. And in the evening, when it feels after a whole hot day, when it feels hot and humid and uncomfortable, that comes from the heat of Gehenim. And then the Gemara says the other way around, maybe, because after all, in the morning, fine, right now it feels cold, but it's getting ready for a hot day, as opposed to in the evening, you have the heat of the day has lessened in intensity, and therefore that comes from Gan Eden. Then Yehoyada also has a long discussion over here about Bechlal. It comes out from this Gemara on the face of it that Gan Eden is a physical place on earth, so that we can talk about it being in the east and then so forth. But, you know, again, it's a little hard to understand. He says when we're, you know, the earth is a globe and it's suspended in the middle of space and there's no... So he says, basically, his explanation is, he goes into a whole arichus about it, but basically his explanation is, yes, Gan Eden is located on earth, but it's in a ruchniastic reality which can't be perceived by our senses. So there he explains with that, for example, the Gemara elsewhere mentions that Gan Eden and Gehenim, for that matter, are much larger than the earth. How is that possible if they're places on earth? Because they exist on earth, but they're not perceivable with our senses. They're ruchniastic realities.
Another dimension,
basically. Yeah, you can say it like that. Yeah.
They merge together.
Say what? When Mashiach comes, they merge together? I don't know, maybe. I once saw a vote on this also, this that the Gemara is saying that the sunrise and the sunset reflect Gan Eden and Gehenim. First of all, the Or HaChaim HaKadosh mentions it in one place in his Pirush. He says in particular it's a message to a person every day as the sun is setting, as the day is finishing, and when the Gemara is saying it's passing in front of Gehenim, it gives take a cheshbon nefesh, you know, what did you accomplish today, and are you really taking care to stay out of there? But that, I saw a vote on that expands on that point a little further. I don't remember the source of the vote. I saw it many years ago. That basically what you have is the Gemara is saying twice a day you have a reminder of that there's a Gan Eden and there's a Gehenna, and keep in mind, you know, you think so the sun rising and setting is the most natural thing. Nobody pays any attention because it's so common, but it's meant to give you an opportunity to reflect. You know, be aware there's a Gan Eden and there's a Gehenna, and what does that mean as far as your avoda? Towards the end of the perek, the Gemara talks. So again, the whole perek has been talking about dinim of buying and selling. So towards the end of the perek, it starts talking about the dinim of honest weights and measures, which we know the Torah is very makbid on. The Gemara is going to talk about it in some length. So you have like this. The Mishnah explains, and the Gemara is going to explain that when you're measuring out things, when you're measuring out commodities, grain, flour, or meat, or whatever it is, to somebody with a balance scale of the kind of balance scale with two pans that they had back then, you have to give them a little extra. Basically, to make sure the idea is to make sure that you're not underweighing for him, which would be a very serious avera. So therefore, you're supposed to give him a little extra. Lahavdil, by the way, you ever heard the expression in English, a baker's dozen? So that means 13. They say the reason is because back in the day, the law was that bakers would also get in trouble in whatever Goyish country, England, I think, or whatever, if they gave underweight bread. So therefore, they developed the practice of giving a 13th, and that way they can be sure that they're not running foul of that law. So Lahavdil, we have the same kind of thing over here to give a little extra to the customer. Yeah.
Some businesses rounded up.
Sometimes business is rounded up, So the Mishnah says v'chayv lach ria loy tefach. So now what you do is like this. Again, you have a balance scale. What you have to do is you have to tilt the scale by one tefach, in favor of the customer. The Gemara explains this is talking about specifically when you're measuring out for the person at least a litra of meat or whatever it is. A litra is approximately a pound. So if you're just measuring out for him a couple of ounces, you don't have to do a tefach. That would be far too much in favor of the customer. You don't expect the storekeeper to take that much of a loss. But we're saying if you're measuring him out, or if you're weighing him out at least a litra, then you have to make sure that the side with the meat on it, let's say that you're selling him, weighs at least a tefach lower than the other side where you have the weights that you're using to weigh it. So on one side of the scale, you're going to have a pound or a litra weight, for example. On the other side, you're going to have a litra of meat. Make sure that you're putting enough extra meat on there that it tilts downward a tefach compared to the other side. The Mishnah continues. Hoya shoker like ayin ba'ayin. Suppose instead that he's giving him an eye for eye weight, meaning in other words that the two pans are supposed to be exactly balanced, so that it looks to your eyes that they're balanced and they look like two eyes, one right opposite the other. Then nosim le gerumin. Then instead, what you have to do is you have to add a gerumin. You have to add a little extra after you finish the weighing, and the Gemara will define what that percentage is. So the Gemara says menohani mili. How do we know this from? Now the Gemara begins. Rashbam points out, by the way, this word girumin is an interesting one. Where does it come? How does girumin come to mean something extra? Rashbam explains that it's also lashon hachra, a lashon of tilting something. So in other words, you could either be tilting it on the scales or tilting it in favor of the customer once you finish weighing it. The idea is, Rashbam says, like you have in shchita, one of the five things that passes a shchita is called hagroma. Namely, when you're shechting with a knife, and instead of making a straight cut straight through, instead you go too high or too low on the windpipe or on the esophagus. That's hagroma, like you're tilting the knife in the wrong direction, out of the zone where you're supposed to do it. The same way over here, girumin would mean tilting the scale in favor of tilting the scale or tilting the extra amount in favor of the customer. So the Gemara says, Minohani Mili, from where do we know this? And the Gemara is assuming, says Rashbam, that when we say, where do we know this, means how do we know this idea that you have to do hachra, that you have to tilt the scale by tefach. Amar Resh Lakish, the Amar Kras, the Resh Lakish says, based on the Pasuk, Evan Shlema Bat Tzedek, the Pasuk says that you'd have to have stones, which they used for weighing in those days, stone weights, you have to have a complete stone that weighs the amount that it says on it, Bat Tzedek. Now, the simple meaning of tzedek means justice. In other words, that it weighs the right amount. But the Gemara's understanding, tzedek m'loshin tzedakah. Tzedek m'sholcha v'ten loy. Give a little extra tzedakah of your own. In other words, Rashbam says, even though it's an Eifer, even though it's an Evan Shlema or Eifer Shlema or whatever it describes in the Pasuk over there, on top of that, you have to do tzedek. So that means give him the little extra. So the Marasi, Hochi, Ema Sefer. See, if you're telling me that this concept of making the scale tilt in favor with the meat or whatever, in favor of the customer, is Midaraisa, Ihochi, Ema Sefer. What about though the Mishnah is continuing? Hoyashoika like Ein Bain, and instead of you weighing the scale and keeping the pans exactly balanced, Nosen the Gerumen, and instead you add him a little extra after the fact, the Iachra Daraisa. If you're telling me that Midaraisa, you have to tilt the scale because of a Tzedek, Hechi Yoiv like Ein Bain, then how could there ever be an option to do Ein Bain and I'll add something afterwards? So therefore, we can't say that's daraisa to tilt the scale. Ella,
the question I have is: if you're supposed to have honest weights, right?
Yeah.
So then, how do you say someone to tilt the scales?
So what we're saying is like this: let's say, for example, so a person comes into your store and wants a pound of meat. Let's say. So you start by taking out your pound weight, you put it on one side of the scale, then you cut out, and then you cut some meat and cut what you think is approximately a pound, and you put it on the other side. Now, let's say, for example, the lachriyah would mean now that you put it on and it does weigh in fact exactly a pound, and the two sides are equally balanced. Now, hachra would mean you have to add a little extra meat while it's still on the scale, so that when you're finished putting it on, the side with the meat is one tefach lower than the other side.
So the food should be,
you should add a little extra to the food so that the customer is getting a little extra.
It means
not to tamper with the scale. It means to add a little food on that side to make sure. Right, and then the other possibility the Mishnah is saying is that instead, after you finish weighing it, you take it off the scale, and then you add the gerumin, and then you add that after you've taken it off the scale. So the Gemara answers, you're right. Ela reisha b'makom shenagu. Rather, no. When the Mishnah talks about tilting the scale is not exeris hakosav, it's just a local minhag. If you want to do that while you're weighing, rather than adding the extra amount, then you can do that. Then the pasuk just wants that you should add a little extra for the customer. The Torah doesn't care. The Torah Shebachsav at least doesn't care whether you do it during the weighing or after the weighing. So that will depend on minhag hamakom. So the Shlokesh statement and his sourcing it to the pasuk is referring to the sefer, where it says Hoyashoka like ayin ba'ayin noisin the gerumin, that if he's weighing it eye to eye, meaning that we're going to keep the pans exactly balanced, and then when are we going to add the thing? You add it afterwards. You add the gerumin afterwards. Menani mili. From where do we know that from? Omer Shlokesh Yomakrov Tzedek Tzedek Mishal Chavatenoi. So in other words, the Torah wants you. Now, one way or the other, you're giving the customer a little extra. Whether you want to do it during the weighing or whether you want to do it after the weighing, that depends on minhag hamakom. V'kama gerumin. Now, if you're going to add gerumin, if you're going to add the little extra for the customer, then how much do you have to add? What percentage? Amarab abba ba memel. Amarab echad ma'asora b'litra b'lach la'asora litri. For every 10 litrin of liquid that you're measuring out, you have to add 1/10 of a litra, meaning, in other words, 1%, 1/100. So you're weighing them out. You're weighing them out, 100 litra of liquid, then you would have to give them 101. Maharsha explains the symbolism of it is like this. We know that a person gives a person gives Meiser, and the Eibishter benches him with wealth. Aser b'shvil shetes aser. Now, you have the famous story, Marshall mentions, famous story from a medrash where there was a guy who had a field that every year would produce 1,000 kor of produce, and every year then he'd give 100 for Meiser from it, because 10%. When he passed away and left it to his son, he told him, you make sure always to give Meiser from it. Meanwhile, the son starts getting cheap. Well, I don't have to give 100, I can give 90, and the next year the field produces only 900. Well, I had a bad year, next year I'm going to give only 80, and it goes down and down, and over the years, eventually it gets to the point where the field is producing only 100 instead of the original 1,000, and then at that point, the guy's family all dressed up in yomtiv clothes and come to him as though they're coming to a party, and he's like, you're coming to a party, I'm in the poorhouse over here, I'm miserable. They tell him, no, you get a mazel tov. Till now, you were the balabas and the Eidishter was the kohen. Now, the Eidishter is the balabas and you've been promoted. You're now a kohen. So the guy got the message and realized he's going to be in and realized he has to be careful from now on giving Meiser. Now, Marsha says, we have to ask on that story. It's a cute little story. But why are we calling the Eidishter the kohen in that story? Why are we calling originally the Eidishter the kohen and now the and now the, and now the son, the balabas? Why are we calling him a kohen? My tradition goes to the lady. So the idea is, in other words, he says like this. Ultimately, if you have 100, then you're giving one of Trumas Meiser to the Kohen, because you give 10 to the Levi, and the Levi in turn gives one to the Kohen. So when you have 1,000 bushels, then the Kohen's share is 10 bushels, and when it goes down to 100, then it's only one. The idea is basically, in other words, he says that you would really only have when you give your maestris properly, the Eidishter gives you 99 times more than you would have, 100 times more, but in other words, 99 times extra what you could have expected. We find that Yitzchak Avinu Meir Shorim, but more generally, there's that idea that you planted a certain amount, and the Eidishter is giving you an extra 99 times as much. So now, therefore, you should be willing to, you got all that bracha from Hashem, you should be willing to be mevater 1/100th in favor of the other person. So that's why we're saying over here that you give 100th of the that you give 100th the same idea. In other words, as you, if it hadn't been for Hashem's bracha, you would have only had 100th.
How does that correspond with the 10% or 20%?
So the fact is, you're giving meiser to the Levi, but ultimately meiser min ha-meiser is the kohen. So in other words, Marsha is saying what would have happened, in other words, is if it weren't for Hashem's bracha, all you would get out of your field would be the 100th of the produce, which winds up going to the Kohen as Tumas Maisu. Instead, the Eidishter gives you a bracha and gives you 99 times as much extra. So therefore, that would have been yours, and the rest you got from the Eidishter's bracha. So what would have belonged to you, you should be mevater to somebody else, and that's how we get the 100th. And then Marsha goes on to explain in this connection some other relevant Gemaras about this. The Gemara ends up pointing out that actually here we only mention liquids. We didn't say anything about solids. The Gemara brings a suffix about it. The Rambam ends up asking that what it is with liquids, as we're saying, it's 100th. With solids, like things like flour or meat or whatever, all you have to give is 1/400th extra. So the Gemara continues, Amar Levi, Kosha Oinshan Shal Midas Yosema Oinshan Shal Arayis. The punishment for a person doing dishonest measures, underweight measures, or doing other kinds of things that, as the Gemara is going to go through over here and talk about various dinim in that regard, the punishment for doing that is greater even than the punishment for Arayis. But Shazen Nemah Behen Eil, Vizem Nemah Behen Eila. Because when it comes to Arayas, the Pasuk says, Kiyas Kol HaTeivas HaEil. The Pasuk says that all of these things that the Goyim did, then Hashem kicked them out of Eretz Yisrael. As opposed to by the Zen Nemah Behen Eila, whereas when it comes to false weights and things like that, the Pasuk says, Ki Toyavas Hashem Kol Oise Eila. So Eila implies something stronger than Eil. So first of all, my mashma dahai ale kosher. Where do we see the word ale? The simple meaning of ale and ale both means these. So where do we get that ale means something harsh? Dichtiv, that's ale or oretz lokach. We find that the pasuk mentions about Nebuchadnezzar when he first conquered Eretz Yisrael, that he took the mighty ones of the land. He took the Talmid Chachamim and the important government ministers, whatever, and took them into Golos and Babel. So we see that the word ale means strong and powerful. In fact, by the Eibishter's name, Kael also has that meaning. The Eila, Koshim Eil, and then Eil, and Ter Eila is even stronger because you have the extra hay showing that it's even stronger and harsher.
The extra hay?
Because of the extra hay.
It shows stronger.
It shows stronger because of the hay. The hay, in other words, intensifies it. It means not just Eil, but it's Eile. But first, so the Gemara asks, so we're going to get back to your point about Kodesh, in a moment. But first, the Gemara asks, Gabi Arayis Nami Hoksiv Eila. By Arayis, it also says the word Eila. Ki kol asher yasmi kol ta'eva sa Eila. But the answer is, Hahul ma'utin midis li kores. What that tells us is that if a person has false weights and measures, then he doesn't get kores for it. So in that sense, yes, the punishment for Arayis is harsher in that it's kores, where, in other words, otherwise we would have thought, Rashbam says, otherwise, since both of them are called te'eva, so we would have thought that to make a greater shava between them and say that a person gets kores for false measures. So the Eila tells us don't do that, that in fact there's no kores in that connection. Then the question is, we're saying that the punishment for Midas is harsher, but Arayas is Kores, Midas there isn't. So in what sense then is the punishment for Midas greater? The answer is the Hossam Epshe Truva, the Hochola Epshe Truva. The difference is with Arayas, the person can do Truva. And a person does Truva, then he's Potter, he's Potter from Kores. First of all, Rashbam points out, first of all, he could get Malkus. And if he gets Malkus, then he's Potter from Kores. We have the Mishnah tells us in Midas. In Marcus, yeah. So first of all, a person gets Malkus, then he's Potter from Kores. But second of all, even without that, Tshuva by itself will be effective enough that if he does proper Tshuva, then the Eibishter will forgive him. Okay, yeah, the Gemara in Yuma mentions there has to be Yom Kippur as well, there may have to be Yisurim as well, fine, but the point is it's possible to clean it up. As opposed to when it comes to false weights and measures, the problem is it was the rabbin. He had many customers over the years. He can't possibly know who are the particular people that he cheated in order to be able to do so, the Heshavas Hegzela. So therefore, it will never be a full-fledged Tshuva. Now, the Gemara does mention in the Sugya that what a person should do in that case, Yasubem Tzorchei Rabin, he should take the money that he gained illegally and use them for public works projects. But so that helps to some extent because it means most likely at some point or other his former customers will use those things. But nevertheless, the fact remains that it's still not really the best kind of Tshuva. Tosfos points out that when you have there are riots that involve mamzerus, for example, then as the Mishnah tells us in Chagiga. That's from Uvas Lo Yucholiska, and that's a crooked thing that can't be made straight, and therefore proper tshuva is not really going to be so possible. But then Tosfos goes on to say, brings from Rabbeinu Chaim, that no, it is true, Uvas Lo Yucholiska, and there does exist the mamzer in the world, as the Alter Rebbe puts in Tanya and in Perek Zayin, that already became into a boss of the dumb, and therefore it's not so possible to do tshuva. Nevertheless, still, the Ibishta tells him to do tshuva, he can accomplish that. The Ibishta tells him, in that case, do tshuva, and that's it, and then you've done your part, and then that's it. He's done his part, as opposed to, again, Gazlan, it's supposed to be the Heshiva Sagzela, and he can't do it because he doesn't know who to return it to.
He's most an effort on Arias, not to do it.
Well, a person may well be most nefesh on Arias not to do that, but the point is, even if he did do it, the point is that the Ben Chaim is saying all he needs to do at that point, what he's responsible for that point is to do tshuva. Hashem doesn't hold him more responsible than that. Fine, there may be a mamzer, and in that sense, more of a slayer for listening, but nevertheless, he's done his part, as opposed to when there's Gezel involved. Now, you have the famous story with the chassid of the Alter Rebbe and the Mittel Rebbe of Yosef Peshenkovitz there, the Alter Rebbe told him you're going to become a wagon driver, and eventually he goes, he meets up years later with a yid who's been completely off the derech for a long time and married a goita and had children with her, and then when the guy does sincere tshuva, then he gets the news shortly afterwards that his wife and children drown. So that's an example where even there it was the goof boss of a dumb, but he did such tshuva law that caused that disappeared. But the bederach klal, you don't have that. But still, as Tosfos is saying, still at least he did what he could. Mashenkin, when it comes to gezel, then no. So in this connection, the Gemara continues, V'omer Ablevi, kosher gezel head, yet yosim gezel gavaya. We see that stealing from a regular person is considered more serious than stealing from the Eibishter. Because we see when the Torah describes about a person who stole from somebody else, who denied money that he owes him or whatever, right away it says nefesh kisechta. A person did an aveira. And what was his aveira? Umala mal b'Hashem, that he was disloyal to Hashem and defrauded somebody else of money. So the first thing is it calls him a choyte. As opposed to when it comes to me'ila, the expression is nefesh kisimo mal. A person did something disloyal. And what did he do? V'chota b'shgoga mekodshe Hashem. He did an aveda b'shogig that he took something from Hashem. He took something from Hekdesh that he wasn't supposed to. So you see that the Torah considers that kind of gezel to be a kind of gezel from Hekdesh to be less serious. Rashbam, Marsha points out that a reason why we would say that is because when you steal from somebody else, then yeah, he's lost it. It's not in his reshus anymore. It comes into your reshus. But when a person does me'ila from the Eidishtha, it still belongs to the Eidishtha. Hashem ha'oritzim loya. The Gemara has the expression in some places, wherever it is, de gaza de rachmona ninu, it's still in the Eidishtha's treasury. So in that sense, he hasn't truly taken out of the reshus of Eidishtha, and in that case, as much as it is an aveira, and he has to repay Hekdesh, he has to bring a korban, etc., nevertheless, the Torah phrases it less severely. I've seen it once pointed out. I think it might have been by Rav Shamshon Ofer Hirsch. I don't remember that this is one of the things where you see where you can clearly see that the Torah was given by the Eibishter, and unlike any other law system that was made by people, no other legal system would say such a thing, that stealing from their temples or whatever is anything but the worst kind of thing. Whereas the Torah considers stealing from a bust of a dumb to be much more serious than stealing from Ekdash. Okay, yeah, we can understand. Yeah. Okay. So this world is the time when we have the battle between Tov and Ra. And as the pasuk says, sometimes one is stronger, sometimes the other. So sometimes Tov wins, sometimes the opposite. Yemosa Mashiach, when we finish that melchama and we complete refining the Tov out of the Ra, and now they're completely separated, and we go out of Golos, now we'll reach the perfection of the way people were before the Chet Eitz Hadas, so we won't be under, as the Zohar puts it, under Ilona the Tov Ra, the tree, the eighth Tov Ra, but there still will be a Sitra Achra in the world, because as the Alter Rebbe talks about in Tanya, there'll still be an Erev Rav, and they'll still be under the domination of that, but the Jewish people, the core Jewish people will not be under that anymore, because Tov and Ra will have been completely separated. And then in tomorrow's installment, the Rebbe continues to talk about that there'll be something even greater than that when it comes to the time of Tchias and Esim. Okay. Afala for the Beis, the Rambam famously describes the characteristics of David, Melech Mebeis David, Hoygabat Torah, the Yoke of Kor Yisrael, etc. The definition of Mashiach is that he's going to restore all the dinim of the Torah to the way they were. And then, how do we test whether a person is genuinely Mashiach? Is it itself? Does he learn Torah and does he keep mitzvahs? So now you have three details in that. Hoygabat Torah means that he personally is Iber Gegeben to Torah, to learning Torah and keeping it. Yokuf Kor Yisrael means that he's going to accomplish that Shlemos by the whole Jewish people. And Yochum, Muhammad Hashem, means that he's going to take away anything that would prevent us from the Umas Olam that would prevent. So therefore, that says, the Rambam says, then therefore we'll be free to learn the Torah and its Chochma and not have anybody harassing us and anybody preventing us. Right.
Right. But that is nothing else.
In other words, it's only just you and Mashiach. That's it, yeah. Well, was that in the beginning? There'll be the Rambam learns that, yeah, at the beginning it will still be Olam Tumin Hagenoyeg, but yeah. Okay. Continuing with halachas of tzitzis. Okay, so we talked about yesterday, by the way, about leather clothing that is potter from tzitzis. I was mentioning there was a discussion among Achronim about polyester, so I looked it up, actually. First of all, we're not talking about, let's say, for example, you take a sheet of plastic and you make it into a four-cornered thing like a poncho or something. That for sure is potter. If even leather is potter, Allah has come of a time of that. No, we're talking about something that's woven out of polyester threads. So you have basically sholosh deis v'dover. Rav Moshe holds not chayiv in tzitzis at all. In fact, he holds that even a person can't even wear such tzitzis on Shabbos, because it would be considered carrying the tzitzis in Rosh Hashanah. On the other hand, the tzitzis of the Yazir holds they are chayiv in tzitzis, because they're forward woven. And Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank says it's kind of a middle ground. He says it depends how the polyester was first manufactured. If it was manufactured as a sheet, and then it was made from that into fibers, into threads, then it would be like leather, and then we would say it's potter. But if it was to begin with extruded in the factory as threads, then it would be chayiv in tzitzis, he says. Either way, though, it would be only, at most, d'rabbanan, the same way as we learned before about cotton and other fabrics like that. Better don't do that. Yeah, better wear wool tzitzis and have done with it.
Okay.
So that's the thing. We learned about before, the preferable thing to do is to wear wool tzitzis, and that way with wool beggar, you're yotze daraisa l'chol alma. When you wear other fabrics, then there's a question whether you're yotze daraisa or darabana. So now continues out together. Okay, at this point we'll continue tomorrow. We just summarized that from about the polyester from yesterday. Fine. Okay.